Hello and welcome to the May 25th edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I'm Anthony Bardaway and I'm here with my colleague Romeo Kakratsky.
Hey folks.
This week's episode will largely deal with the continuing Ukrainian small counteroffensive around Bakhmut, as well as a rather interesting raid by Russian, pro-Ukrainian Russian, rather, forces into the Belgorod region of Russia. We'll then go on to some other assorted combat topics regarding a large missile attack on Kyiv that was thwarted, as well as delivering F-16s, finally, to Ukraine. We'll then get on to a diplomatic topic. There were a lot of major summits in this last week that each of them showed something positive for Ukraine, really. And then finally, we'll be turning to a domestic topic about local corruption. So now getting into it. So we're sorry to say that the battle for the city of Bakhmut, specifically the city of Bakhmut, I really have to underline that here, seems to, after many months, been lost. Now, the Russian forces put everything they had, including sacrificing their positions elsewhere around Bakhmut city area, in order to make the final push, in order to nudge Ukrainian forces out of Bakhmut city limits. Now, what I want to compare this to is the last time Russia had a victory over Severodonetsk, almost a year ago now, in June, where after taking Severodonetsk, they are able to effectively cut it off, and the Ukrainian forces had to make a large-scale retreat a considerable distance away to re-set up their battle lines further westward. However, with Bakhmut, it was not this big offensive movement by Russia. It really was just this grinding forward movement. Ukrainian forces did not exactly fall back very far, literally just the other side of Bakhmut city limits. There are numerous battle lines in between Bakhmut and the next urban settlement of Chasiv Yar, which we've talked about many times. We don't need to go over what exactly Chasiv Yar is. And also in between those two areas, there is a ridge. And so not only are we looking at this situation where the Russians are not able to advance much further, and it really is just a matter of being on one side of the line or the other, not a huge strategic difference between those two things. But even more importantly, it seems as though the Russian forces that took part in this final push wanted to kind of quit the battlefield. Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner group, just straight up declared victory, said that Wagner would have to withdraw, allow its positions to be taken over by a regular Russian army, and leave, which means that there really isn't any plans to go any further than that, at least in the near future. And we'll get into what the future looks like at the end of the combat updates, but that is very much something to keep in mind. This is not a blossoming of offensives, but rather just the difference between a few meters and another few meters, ultimately.
And I want to reiterate what I think is an important point to keep in mind when thinking about the Battle of Bakhmut, is that Ukraine's goal in this battle was never to kick the Russians out. That would have been a nice side effect. It was specifically and emphatically a trap for the Russians to waste all of that 8 months or 9 months of manpower on taking this strategically, basically irrelevant settlement that is incredibly difficult to defend, that is open to assaults from all sides, that is situated in disadvantageous terrain. And in that sense, Ukraine actually succeeded. The city may or may not be under Russian control, whatever that means on the battlefield, but Russia did lose quite a bit of its already stretched resources into taking what is the opposite of a prize. It's like going to Chuck E. Cheese's and instead of getting a birthday pizza. They just bring you a rotten pile of mozzarella. That's pretty much what the Russians have won here. The defending units that they have in Bakhmut are not well motivated. Wagner has been destroyed, or at least rendered, according to Prigozhin himself, a non-viable fighting force because of all of the massive losses that they've taken. And again, it will not be all that difficult for Ukraine to push the Russians out of it when push comes to shove. So it is very important to always remember Bakhmut in this context and not as some strategic set piece battle that Ukraine has lost. That's simply not the case.
Yeah. If you've been listening to this podcast, we've explained a lot of our reasons. So we don't really need to go over that for the umpteenth time. But I remember that when we were having our episode around New Year's Day, actually, we were saying that Bakhmut was not long for this world. And here we are in late May, almost to June, and it finally happened. So quite frankly, we underestimated Ukrainian performance in Bakhmut. I think I expected this to go in February, maybe March, and here we are. So I'm not exactly surprised. The country did pay a very heavy price in this battle, but that heavy price would have been paid somewhere. And from a grand strategy standpoint, and again, we'll get into this a bit later, it seems to have paid out what Ukraine wanted to do there. And in the meantime, in order to make this final push in through the last bits of the last kind of apartment blocks in the far western corner of Bakhmut, Wagner had to sacrifice its positions to the north and south of the city, the flanks. And last episode, we talked about how this had really paid off. This had really shown itself in Ukraine being able to push away Russia from the north and south areas of the city. We talked about how between two different front offensives, Ukraine was able to basically semi-encircle the Russian forces that were attacking towards Chasiv Yar and Ivanovska. And I said that there is a strong threat to that force being surrounded and destroyed. And what do you know? That's what happened. That tendril of the Russian lines reaching out towards Chasiv Yar was destroyed. And now Ukrainian forces are assaulting towards the Russian-occupied town of Klishivka, which could fall at some point. And as this was all happening, Prigozhin, again, the head of the Wagner group, was completely complaining about the performance of the Russian army, saying how, oh, we are sacrificing our flanks in order to take Bakhmut. How dare you do it? When he was the one who did it. Like, he was the one who made the choice to sacrifice the flanks to take the rest of Bakhmut. The Russian army definitely noticed this. And this ongoing story that we've been talking about of how there is increasing tension between regular army and Wagner that could lead to more negative effects for them in the future, that very much stepped up here. It is so very obvious what Prigozhin did and who he did it at the expense of, and using the Russian army as a scapegoat for the decision that he made to sacrifice Bakhmut's flanks will pay off at some point.
And mind you, you don't have to take our word for it. This analysis is also shared by war criminal Igor Gherkin of Downing M17 fame. He himself went on Telegram and wrote a screed. Obviously, while we are celebrating all the things that we mentioned in our analysis, he is bemoaning them. He called the quote-unquote victory at Bakhmut a Pyrrhic one, and did note that Russia taking Bakhmut and the sacrifice of their flanks opens the Russians up to Ukrainian counterassaults. So this is a near obvious conclusion and near obvious progression of this battle to basically anyone with half a brain. And Gherkin, who I remind our listeners is a convicted war criminal, and committer of crimes against humanity, has some amount of brain in his head, or at least enough to realize the obvious consequences of this battle.
And he does have clout within the Russian far-right nationalist milieu, where he kind of says what they're all thinking. And it's just that while we kind of point and laugh at the Russians' foibles here, these Russian nationalist extremists are kind of wanting to take advantage of these divisions for themselves. They want a weakening of the people above them and the power vertical so they can take advantage of it. So the tactical victory in Bakhmut is turning into a serious political conundrum for Ukraine's enemies.
And speaking of serious political conundrums, another rather surprising one popped up just this week. And I'm sure all of our listeners are aware of this, but if you're not, on May 22nd, two Ukraine-affiliated Russian units, the Russian Volunteer Corps and the Freedom of Russia Legion, claimed that they had separately crossed the Ukraine-Russian border into Russian Belgorod Oblast and began, quote-unquote, liberating villages alongside the border and, surprisingly, a well way into Russian territory itself. This incursion was not met with a robust Russian defense. In fact, beyond sporadic battles, it seems like, as of when we're recording this, that these two Russian units are kind of holding their line, and they are, in their words, liberating Belgorod Oblast.
If you remember them, these are the same people who did some raids into Bryansk Oblast that we talked about. The raid number one, I'll call it, resulted in a lot of them being killed and really nothing to show for it. The second raid had to do with them kind of going in, taking a selfie in front of some village administration building and going home. So before this, it was kind of a joke and still is pretty funny, to be honest. But this third one seemed to have actually accomplished something. So they entered at the village of Guzinka border crossing. I forget the name of the, doesn't particularly matter what the name of the border is called itself. And then proceeded not only through that village, but about three other villages before hitting the slightly larger one of Grevron. And this was not, you know, an especially strategic place to strike, but it is so very notable that it took Russia very long to put together any kind of reaction force. And while it seems like this incursion is mostly over by now, it's very unclear what's actually happening on the ground, although there's something happening, we don't really know what. And this is an area not far from Kharkiv. This is an area that had been hit by Ukrainian suicide drones, for example. This is not safe territory for Russia, really. It is notably close to the front line. You'd think there'd be some kind of border guard there, and it seems like there just really wasn't.
As I've repeated many times on this podcast and on Twitter and to anyone with an earshot, the likely reason, at least in my head, why Russia was unable to properly respond to what amounts to an insurgency grabbing control of a chunk of their territory is because everyone's dead. Russia has taken, for a modern army, simply incredible losses. Understand that in the modern world, in the, like, let's say from the 1980s on, war has been deadly, but the casualty rates are nothing approaching historical wars. Medical technology is better, evacuation technology is better, Soldiers have better trainings. Combat medics have better trainings. The equipment is better. War is fought increasingly long distances using automated technology, such as drones or remote controlled missiles. People just don't die at the rate that the Russians have been killing themselves in modern warfare. This not only has had an incredibly deleterious effect on the morale of the Russian forces, but it has quite literally simply killed almost anyone with any ability, talent, or experience. All of Russia's elite forces were all but eliminated in the first year of the war, closer to the first 6 months of their full-scale war. All the repeated attempted landings at Hostomel, at the airbase in Vasilkiv, they just used all of their best guys, and now all of those guys are dead. Ukrainian snipers have been very good at eliminating Russia's officer corps. The constant sabotage deep within Russia itself has caused enormous psychological damage to both newly mobilized recruits and civilian workers. Russia just cannot really respond. Everyone who says, well, Russia, they're a huge country. It's a huge country, but they've had a demographic crisis for at least the past, since pretty much the end of the Second World War. They've never recovered to previous fertility levels, and it's simply been exacerbated. They didn't have that many young men to start with, thus the whole demographic crisis, and they've hollowed that out even more. There is quite simply nowhere Russia can pull from. Even their internal security forces, who would typically be sent to reassert order or control in a situation like this, they all died in Ukraine because the Russians sent essentially riot police into a war zone onto the battlefield, where they were probably promptly all shot to death and then shelled, or in whatever order you prefer. The fact of the matter is, Russia doesn't have the people. Any forces that they pull to retake these claimed territories by these pro-UA Russian units will have to, by necessity, be pulled from parts of the Russian defenses. And a military analyst recently calculated the Russians are estimated to have about 200,000 men dug in across a good portion of the front line, notably, of course, not up Nil Belgorod, but down towards Bryansk. And all of those guys are pretty much untrained conscripts who were shown what a rifle looks like yesterday, given a uniform that, if they're lucky, came from the Vietnam War era, and then told to go sit in a trench and wait. These are not special operations forces that are capable of quick and decisive precision strikes on enemy units. The kind of forces that you need to push back an insurgency. Russia just doesn't have those guys. So any of these idiotic alcoholic conscripts that they pull off of the defense are guys that are essentially the last line for that area of the front, meaning that when Ukraine goes to assault those trenches, they will be empty and there will be no reinforcements that the Russians can send. That is simply the reality of the situation for Russia and why it is having such a hard time struggling with two relatively unsupported small Russian units within their own territory.
Small as in we're talking about a force of about 100 people here.
Yeah, this isn't even 1,000 men. It's definitely not 10,000. It's legitimately the size of a high school basketball team plus their parents.
Yeah, like the stands of a high school sport game in a small city that people don't care about. That's the force we're talking about here. Not something that's hard to fight against if you had anything to fight against it with. They are a rounding error. And this is after Russia made a big show with, you know, the overhead shots of drone footage of putting up these layers of trenches along the Ukrainian-Russian border with the dragon's teeth, they're called tank traps, and all these other fancy pants things. And they just rolled right on by it. And during this whole thing, Ukraine also shelled and attacked Belgorod city itself. The FSB headquarters in Belgorod was hit by a suicide drone that put a hole in the roof. Not huge strategic things so much as a real slap in the face, which is what they were really going for. The response on social media, of course, was hilarious. Everyone was, because these are Russians who went in to attack Russia. So everyone was kind of taking the talking points of Russia setting up the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republic and then just flipping it around. We are now liberating the Belgorod People's Republic. All these tanks they found were just found in the backyard of a military surplus store, what the Russians said about the DNR forces and how they somehow acquired one of the largest tank armies in Europe. About how we're respecting the sovereign choice of the local people here, and that there was an election, like just taking this trolling of the highest level going on, of showing just how shallow and pathetic and stupid all the Russian propaganda was back in 2014, 2015. And really, in this case, the fact that these are Russians makes it even more legitimate than the seizure of the Donetsk. When the Donetsk People's Republic was set up, the people who did it were Russian intelligence officers. Igor Girkin, the person we mentioned a bit earlier in the episode, he was the one who did it, a Russian intelligence officer, not locals, Russians. So this trolling, this hearty horror that we're all having, knowing that it's all just for jokes, is more true than when Russia said it.
Though it does bear mentioning, and we're going to talk about this quite a bit, that all of these jokes should not distract from the fact that at least one of the Russian units involved in these raids, as hilarious as they are and as funny as the thought of the so-called liberation of Belgorod Oblast could be, the Russian Volunteer Corps is an explicitly neo-Nazi movement led by an explicit neo-Nazi with a history of violence and criminal charges both in Russia and in Ukraine, who has served time in Ukraine, who has written in favor of various neo-Nazi mass murder sprees across the world, notably New Zealand. These are the Russian Volunteer Corps are not good people. They are explicitly and proudly Nazis. They explicitly call for the eradication of non-Aryan peoples, as they say, in Russian territory. They explicitly advocate for the formation of a Nazi state in Russia. Their problem with Putin is not that he is a horrible repressive dictator. It is that he is a horrible repressive dictator who doesn't want to share power with Nazis.
Yeah, it's really just a matter of personal choice that led any of the people in the Russian Volunteer Corps into the Russian Volunteer Corps, as opposed to Rusich or Wagner or any of these other Russian far-right formations. There is no difference in the ideology there, just a difference in who they thought they wanted to fight against. In this case, they thought it was more important to bring down the Russian state that allowed Central Asian and Caucasian people to live within it, rather than winning the war and using that backing to then take over the state afterwards, which is what seems to be the case with the Wagnerites and Russian neo-Nazis on that side. It's just a matter of order of operations for them. And if there's been complaints about the amount of coverage of the far right in Ukraine, I do not always agree with those complaints. Sometimes I do. We don't have to go into that now. But I'd say about 7 times out of 10, when you think of those stories about, you know, Nazis in Ukraine, they're really talking about Denis Nikitin, the leader of the Russian Volunteer Corps. He's the one that has kind of become a focal point for the most extreme of the extreme right in Ukraine. So he's not a good guy by any stretch of the imagination. There is a debate, of course, whether using these people is a positive or a negative. Personally, I think that the balance here is more or less okay, seeing as how the Russian Volunteer Corps is largely independent of the Ukrainian military. They're keeping enough distance from them to not take ownership of them. It is a Russian group being supported with by Ukrainian intelligence rather than any kind of arm of the Ukrainian armed forces. And there's been a lot of kind of, even before this, people were really kind of making fun of them quite a bit for being a bunch of losers.
And mind to wade into controversy a little bit, I personally am uncomfortable with my government supporting a group of guys whose leader has explicitly written he wants to murder people like me. I am mixed race. I am half Ukrainian and half Bangladeshi. And Nikitin's literally written screeds about how race mixing is evil, race traitors should be eliminated, and mixed people should be euthanized. Because he's a Nazi. These are basic Nazi positions that he holds because, and I repeat, he's a Nazi. So I personally don't feel comfortable that my government is affiliated with these kinds of assholes in any way, shape, or form beyond the justice system throwing these people in prison. And mind you, a lot of these guys that are in the Russian Volunteer Corps were literally pulled out of prison to join the RKD or the RDK, whatever the correct acronym is. It is very likely that Ukrainian military intelligence told them they can either rot in a cell or kill Putin's dogs. I am almost positive that is a one-for-one recreation of the offer these guys were getting. And of course, they took the offer that lets them take guns and revel in violence because, and I repeat for the umpteenth time, they are open, proud Nazis who want to kill me and everyone who looks like me and pretty much anyone else who doesn't fit the Nazi ideal. The Freedom of Russia Legion is a little less problematic in that sense, though again, a lot of the Russians in Ukraine have not been liberal, democracy-loving oppositionists. In many cases, these have been Nazi or neo-Nazi or white nationalist trash bags who have gotten into too much trouble, legal trouble in the Russian Federation, and of course, have been hiding in Ukraine to not be arrested by Putin.
Yeah, we've not really talked too much about the far right issue in a while, just because it hasn't been.
It's not really been relevant, or rather, the far right issue is currently the dictator that's invading us.
Yeah, so, but we've mentioned it when we did mention it that essentially before 2014 and open hostilities between Ukraine and Russia, the kind of neo-Nazi milieu in both countries were the exact same thing. Of course, they were both Russian speaking. They went to the same, you know, concerts for the same Nazi bands. They went to the same conferences. They connected to each other on the same Nazi level, including some of the ideological leadership of the Azov movement were literally Duganists. They like it's the same thing. But then when when the war started in 2014, of course, sometimes people had to choose a side, although those connections were still there. And it just became a matter of these far right people in Russia who, again, might have gotten a bit too much legal heat. Decided to that their fate was better served elsewhere where the cops weren't after them as much. Yeah, so Denis Nikitin, kind of fuck this guy. It is extremely funny that this raid happened. And when we kind of coalesce all of our thoughts here, we'll talk about what this will mean in the future. But don't glorify them. That runs the risk of serious issues. Oh, I am a Jew. I do not like the idea of Denis Nikitin existing. Maybe he'll die in the process of, you know, fighting for Ukraine. And if that's the case, cool. But just underline that, please do not glorify the Russian Nazi who has denigrated and physically attacked LGBT people. Within their chats, they will frequently complain about the Chechen and other minorities, other especially non-Slavic minorities in the Ukrainian military. And I really, really just need to say here, the Ukrainian military is multi-ethnic, is accepting of people who even were discriminated against before and are still discriminated against now, including Romani. There are people of all different religions, races, ethnicities, political beliefs. The construction of the Ukrainian political nation is very much a pluralistic one. And people like Nikitin stand against that kind of political self-identity that Ukraine has chosen and has repeatedly chosen over the years, especially with Maidan and making the choice to be a liberal modern state.
I think before we wrap up this little section, I did want to talk a little bit about what Ukraine's motivation could be in forcing this kind of raid planning this kind of raid and planning this kind of operation. Now, this is almost definitely being an operation that was hatched and run by Ukrainian military intelligence, aka HUR, led by Kirilo Budanov, who has proven himself to be quite the effective spy chief over the course of this war. Budanov is just young enough to have avoided going to the KGB schools and the general training schools in Moscow that has tainted and corrupted many older members of the Ukrainian military and security services. And he has shown a distinctly 21st century or maybe even millennial kind of attitude towards some of the norms of warfare that people typically cling to, with this operation being a key example of that. For Budanov and what he said in various interviews, and again, I do want to qualify everything that I say about this operation, about Budanov. This is all working off publicly available information. Budanov is quite literally a spy chief. Anything he says should be taken with a huge grain of salt. I think I've said this on Twitter before, but I'll repeat it again. The purpose of a military officer during war is to kill the enemy. It is not to kill the enemy, but do it in a way that doesn't upset anyone. It is not to uphold some abstract values. It is not to even defend anyone. It is to kill the enemy. Budanov and HUR as a whole, and the Ukrainian military as a whole, their goal, even the Ukrainian government, even the civilian government as a whole, its entire goal is to kill the enemy. Everything he says and does is going to be, especially for Budanov, though loosely this does apply to the rest of the governments and the rest of officials, everything they say and do is going to be calculated with the express intent of causing as much damage to the enemy as possible, whether that be physical, psychological, political, whatever. It is all shaped to kill the enemy. But I will say I do believe Budanov when he has said in his various interviews that he simply wants to beat the Russians. He has no other ideological, or at least he claims, of course, to have no other ideological drives beyond beating the Russians. That's all he wants. And in that kind of mindset, this kind of raid makes perfect sense. We have not really talked about the counteroffensive or analyzed it because it hasn't happened yet. And we're a news podcast, not a speculation podcast, or at least we try to be a news podcast. So we typically cover the news. There has not been the start of a counteroffensive. However, this raid can be seen in the vein of various shaping and probing attacks that we've talked about in previous episodes, namely that this particular operation shows very well the Russian capability to quickly reinforce weak portions of their lines. Obviously, during a counteroffensive and breakthrough, When your forces encounter the enemy lines, you want to capitalize on weaknesses. That is, wherever the lines, the defensive lines are holding the worst, wherever the enemy soldiers are fleeing and running, taking disproportionate casualties, retreating and losing ground, that's where you will want to focus your forces on. And in order to successfully pull off such an operation, you need to understand how quickly can the enemy respond to a breakthrough attempt. Judging by the initial results and the ongoing nature of this raid, of this so-called liberation of Belgorod, the Russians cannot. They cannot respond in a timely and efficient manner to an enemy push along a defensive line. A border is a defensive line, even if it is poorly defended. It is still a defended line. You have agents of the state with firearms and power to shoot people who come close to them without the proper authorization. Those are soldiers by any other name. And the fact that Russia has been, for the second day and counting, unable to push back this tiny force bodes quite well for the rest of the front, because it means that Russia can, A, is not adaptable, B, does not have really mobile reinforcements ready to fill in and plug gaps. And of course, C, means that whatever defenses they do have are probably going to be comparatively weak. Now, obviously, a defensive line with 200,000 men dug in is going to be a little different than a border checkpoint, but a border during war is one that you would assume to be fortified, regardless of whether that border is found next to the zone of active hostilities or is simply a border with the opposing nation. Either way, it should still be a relatively fortified line of defense, which, as we see, 100 dudes, granted with some artillery support, were able to cross, take, capture, and hold pretty easily.
Right. So what do we learn from all this? Well, one, to be put on the pessimistic foot first, throughout the entirety of the attack on Bakhmut, Russia maintained a large advantage in the form of artillery. So straight up through the end, even as there were complaints, you know, of ammunition starvation or whatever, the Russians were always able to shoot more things at Ukraine than Ukraine could shoot things at the Russians. And that will continue to be a problem, even with other improvements to Ukrainian armaments. However, just looking at Bakhmut first. So the concern with Bakhmut was that if Russia was able to fully take the city, they'd be able to move on from there to Chasiv Yar, to Kramatorsk, Close Slovyansk, that urban conglomeration right there. But what we're seeing now is not that. Like I mentioned earlier, Wagner is leaving the field in Bakhmut, or at least they're saying that's happening, and we can never actually trust what Wagner Group says, but they do need to re-outfit and refit themselves before doing anything else. This was a long battle. They lost many men, a lot of equipment. Under any condition, they do have to pause and refit. But it means that in the near future, they're not going anywhere from Bakhmut or anywhere else. And they were the only offensive-capable unit within the Russian military, as we saw from the winter-spring offensive that they tried, where everywhere besides Bakhmut, they were slaughtered. And then, keeping in mind this idea of this whole blossoming outward idea, and also, in order to spread out from Bakhmut, they would actually need to, you know, go in various directions from Bakhmut. And Ukraine has cut off most of the routes that they would be able to take. I think that right now, Bakhmut is pretty much going to be a set position. There is not much use in Ukraine fully taking it back, except as a propaganda win. They may see that as worth it. I think that the priority will be elsewhere. Bakhmut does not exist as a city anymore. There's nothing there left to defend. It is destroyed utterly. I don't know if there's anyone left in there. Anyone who is still in a basement will be drawn out by the Russians and shipped off into a concentration camp before having their kids stolen from them Bakhmut seems like it is just what it's going to be for a while. There could be Ukrainian raids into the city, hold on to a basement, cause trouble. But I don't see much happening there elsewise from either direction for the reasons I just said. The Russians do not have anywhere to spread out from. Their lines of getting out have been destroyed. And also the soldiers who are actually doing the assaulting left. Where could Russia attack in the future? The only plausible place is Avdiivka. Avdiivka is still in its semi-encirclement, although a Ukrainian counteroffensive there have made that easier for the defenders. It's really the only place that is both any kind of strategic point and vulnerable to the Russians. Everywhere else that the Russians have been attacking and failing has been rather relatively minor and just a matter of them trying to push it towards something. But so maybe there will be something in Avdiivka, but I just don't see them having the manpower right now to do anything about it. Which brings me to my next point. The Russians will probably try and have to have some kind of mass conscription at some point soon. They've been having a continuous conscription throughout this whole time, ever since the last mass conscription in the fall. But that mass conscription in the fall was because of the massive losses they took. They do not have the manpower to push any further. Everyone else has died in these other offensives, and they need something. And by having these conscriptions, they will inflame the political situation in Russia, because those were the only thing that really seemed to drag out a lot of serious political consequences, especially for regional leadership within Russia, within Dagestan, within Kalmykia, within all these places that were being heavily conscripted. Was starting to see pushback. And if there is another mass conscription, that pushback will start right back up again. So in addition to these political struggles between the Ministry of Defense, between Wagner Group, between the ultranationalists, we'll be adding in these kind of local political actors who are not so necessarily motivated by ending the war so much as having their localities completely strip mined of fighting age men.
Fighting age men are also working age men. And working age men, especially in areas as underdeveloped as Russia, represent a household's often sole breadwinner.
Right, especially these are the places that also tend to have the larger families, more traditional culture, more conservative culture. And so having their men taken away from them, well, the army is better paying, which is why there had always been a larger recruitment from these areas than anywhere else. But that can only stretch so far. Their payment doesn't work if they're dead.
Yeah, you don't collect a check if you're murdered. And as we already know from many stories from within Russia, widows also can't really collect the benefits for their slain husbands.
Right. So the only hope of Russia doing anything further in this war is through mass conscription. But I just don't see that happening very well. And now to talk about what this can do with this border raid. Again, this border raid was about 100 people. It does not take much effort for Ukraine to gun up 100 people to do something.
And not to mention, these guys, since these guys aren't Ukrainian, it is in, I'm sure, in Hoare's eyes, literally disposable. The equivalent of Wagner mercenary convicts. Just a bunch of really unneeded disposable people that you can use on in really high risk situations and then just see what happens, and you're not too invested in their failure or success.
Right. And that's just them trying to stretch this out over a long period of time. I'm sure you can get 100 Ukrainian soldiers, do a quick lightning raid where you just kind of knock over a border station and go home with very little effort. As we've seen, it wouldn't really require that much effort to do that. And that means that Russia has to actually think more about its border. This has to be tempered out by understanding that Muscovites do not care about the people in these regions. I'm sure within a week, no one in Moscow, none of these Moscow middle classes who Putin is actually somewhat politically responsible and answerable to, they will not care next week that this happened. It might be a bit scary now that they're.
Well, they'll care from a prestige viewpoint, from a prestige perspective of, oh, we look weak because we can't. We look like Ukrainians just losing bits of our country. That's the only motivating factor. They don't give a shit about any of it.
Well, but even then, prestige, like, I think that once this is all over, and it will be over at some point, like, they'll forget. They'll very, very quickly forget. They're not involved in politics. Like, the prestige issue will not matter to them. It's a temporary news item that they might see now, if they even watch the news. So I don't think they care too much about that. But if it keeps happening, if there are these incursions all the time, which, like I said, it could be, it would not be difficult to do, just requires very little effort, manpower, resources to do something like this. If Ukraine can keep doing these things and force Russia to actually defend its border more strictly, again, manpower. Again, going back to this manpower question, they'll have to redeploy more manpower to defend its state boundary between Ukraine and Russia rather than the active combat zone front line. And they can't do that without the conscription that we just talked about and all the problems from there they don't have to repeat. So shaping operation basically expands the potential attack line. I don't think that there will be, you know, an armed spearhead heading towards Voronezh anytime soon. But it means that Russia has to think about these things now when before they clearly weren't.
It also means that if you do want to cause trouble in Voronezh, you don't need to send an armored spearhead. You can send a hundred or a couple of hundred infantry guys with jeeps and some armored vehicles. And then just not pay attention to what happens there and let them cause havoc.
Yeah, so that kind of rounds off what happened and what we think will happen. So now let's go over some kind of more miscellaneous bits about the battle in the air. There's a huge missile attack on Kyiv. When was that?
I don't know. I stopped paying attention, to be honest.
Honestly, don't remember the exact date because time doesn't exist anymore. But there's a big.
Also, the Russians have been launching missile attacks multiple times a day.
It's been a very active month. It's been quite annoying. I haven't really slept through the night in a while. But basically, there is a very large scale missile attack on Kyiv regarding multiple Kinzhals, as well as other. Of the big ones, you know, whenever there's this big missile attack, you might hear about, oh, this the big scary missile that did it, all of those in all their varieties. And accordingly, it seems as though they all failed to hit their targets, thanks largely to the Patriot missile defense system, the word on everyone's mouth in Ukraine for this last week. The Patriot missile defense system is a complex of a bunch of different moving parts where a bunch of different batteries connected to a command module and a radar module spread out over a wide area can take out incoming missiles. The Kinzhals, especially, they are normally hypersonic, meaning faster than the speed of sound, but in order to hit before hitting, they slow down and become easier to intercept. Now, the Russians say that they hit all their targets, but as someone in Kyiv watching this happen and seeing some things actually explode in the sky, it was a very, very loud night. Well, let me tell you that. Everyone noticed that one. And seeing these explosions in the sky of these missiles being intercepted, do not do this, by the way. Go to a shelter. Do not watch out your window. I never follow this advice, but always give it. But it did not happen. Everything failed except for apparently the debris of one of these missiles kind of rained down on the area around one of these Patriot missile batteries and damaged one of those batteries. This was spread in Russia propaganda of them blowing up the Patriots, but in actuality, it was repaired and operational just a few days later, showing that the era of being overly concerned about missile attacks, at least on Kyiv, is over. Though, of course, other cities closer to the front that do not get the same attention as Kyiv are still vulnerable, especially to artillery. If you're in range of artillery, that's a problem. Or if there's just not enough time to see the missiles incoming, as is the case, especially with Kherson. And the second item here with the air battle is F-16s. For many months now, there's been this push for Ukraine to receive F-16 fighter jets. Our Western partners have repeatedly said, no, we're not ready for them. It's too hard to train on them, too hard to supply them, too hard to get them in the air. And eventually they all changed their mind, I guess. And now a large number of countries, including the Netherlands, including the United States, are going to be supplying Ukraine with F-16s. When asked about previous comments about it being a danger to send these F-16s to Ukraine, Biden said that, yes, it's a danger for them, meaning the Russians. He did the call 911, no, but for you meme in real life, which was hilarious. Less hilarious, though, was the time that it took for this to happen. This happens time and time again. Everyone knows what Ukraine needs. Everyone knows what Ukraine is asking for. Everyone knows what will win the war, but they keep dragging their feet to do it until eventually reason wins out and they just do what we've all been trying to push them to do this whole time. And lives could have been saved if it would have happened earlier. So next time Ukraine asks for an update for its armaments, just send it right away. We can skip all this political mess. You're going to do it. And instead of doing it in half a year where there are more deaths because we don't have these weapon systems, just do it now. This there is some news that this push to supply the F-16s came from a more recent news report by kind of leaked information from within Western Air Forces that rather than taking this huge amount of time in order to train up pilots, now Western sources are guessing that it'll only take 4 months. It'll only take 4 months for a Ukrainian pilot to get up and running on this F-16, rather than like the 6 months or a year that they had been saying beforehand. And I assume that it could take even less than those 4 months, because whenever there's this estimate of how much time it takes to train Ukrainians on a new system, they do it in half the time. So once these F-16s are delivered, and there's a big question mark on that, of course, I think by the summer, we could be, by late summer anyway, into the fall, we could be seeing them in the air. Next up in diplomatic news, there were a whole mess of big time fancy pants political conferences throughout the world. It seemed like every political bloc had one in this last week. I'm not entirely sure why it all lined up the time that it did, but it did. And this was the Arab League summit, the Group of Seven, the G7, and a China Central Asia summit. So first, the Arab League. Normally, you would not think this has much to do with Ukraine, seeing as how it is the Arab League is not exactly sharing a border with Ukraine.
But the Arab League does have lots of ties to Russia, which Ukrainian diplomacy has been very hard at work trying to sway traditional Russian allies to Ukraine's side, or at least to neutrality. And B, they are one of the largest sources of Soviet weaponry, and importantly, Soviet artillery munitions, which Ukraine is in desperate need of. With the European sources of these kinds of munitions basically tapped,
the Arab League invited Zelensky to speak there. And as he always does, Zelensky and his team of writers, although apparently Zelensky is one of his major writers, but hats off to them, they are always able to find the exact type of messaging that their listeners will be receptive to. And this has been their major skill. In this case, his speech in front of the Arab League sounded kind of like an old school third worldist. He was talking about how Ukraine had to fight off occupation by these hostile imperialist foreigners. All these talking points that a Middle Eastern person would be very receptive to hearing because it was because they would hear it about themselves, not only in the recent past, but also for a very long time. So he very much gave this speech as though, I am like you, you should help me because I am like you. And this is on the heels of many members of the Arab League kind of shifting their allegiances to supporting Russia a bit more. Egypt was caught trying to sell weapons to Russia, though that was thwarted. Saudi Arabia is a country that has the most capability of damaging Russia by just making oil cheaper. If you make oil cheaper, there goes the Russian economy. And they have been very hesitant for manipulating the fossil fuel markets in that way. So this was not a receptive crowd, but he did his best to tilt them at least in his favor a little bit more than he was beforehand. We've not really seen results for this, really, but him just being there, I think, is a major diplomatic coup. But the other thing to keep in mind here is the grain deal. And Ukraine is a major supplier of food, especially for Egypt, less so some of the others, but in Syria, other places as well, but especially Egypt. And they need to find a way to make this work. So they will not be hostile towards Ukraine. They will not fully buy into supporting Ukraine either, but their material interests are very much in keeping Ukraine alive, at least as far as that goes. And in just being in places is important. And the last thing to say about this Arab League summit is that besides Zelensky, Assad was also there. The Assad regime was welcomed back into the Arab League. So don't expect that summit to be entirely, you know, good natured. There was some kind of laughing at how Assad made a show of taking out his earpiece when Zelensky gave his speech because Assad was going against his common enemy. But it's because Assad speaks English. Don't overthink it. He speaks English very well. So he was just listening to Zelensky speaking directly. Just wanted to add that in.
And I know we are a Ukrainian podcast, but I would just like to make it clear that our position is fuck Assad. He should die in a fire.
Yeah. Assad is a common enemy here. So our next conference is the G7, the Group of Seven. The G7 is kind of considered the planning committee for some of the world's more wealthy and politically powerful countries. These are Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States, along with the European Union as a whole, as a representative there. In addition to the seven members, a bunch of other world leaders show up to do, you know, different deals. There's lots of things going on the side. What's actually part of the official meaning of the G7 is not usually as important as what's going on in these side meetings. So Zelensky was invited to the G7 to do his thing there. And one of these side meetings was with Modi of India. And again, talking about how Ukraine has to engage more with the global south and is trying to do so as they did with the Arab League, Modi might be the most important of these, I hate the term global south, but third power countries, we can call them, not necessarily aligned.
Modi here referring to Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
So Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India, India is the largest country in the world by population, sometimes called the largest democracy. It is a major power player that is often ignored. Throughout this conflict, they have been a lifeline for Russia. The Russians have been wanting to build transit corridors into India in order to use Indian ports more often. India has been buying weaponry from Russia. India has been used as kind of a relief valve for Russian sanctions of all different kinds. But at the same time, India is not exactly fully in Russia's camp either. They are tied strongly to the American economy. They're always worried about China. and they can't allow like a strong Chinese bloc to form necessarily, which Russia would help them do. It's all very politically complicated, and Modi himself is not exactly a good dude. But they had this meeting. Don't know if there's any formal agreements that were hatched out, but the fact that such a meeting took place is very important. People need to be talking to get something done. And there has been cracks shown in this Russian-Indian partnership anyway, due to, you know, everything that we've been talking about. So there is this opening that you can drive a wedge into, which Zelensky was trying to do. And just going off of body language and all that, Modi seemed receptive to.
And as one famous, or I should say infamous, British war criminal once said, jaw-jaw is better than war. The more these guys talk to Ukraine, the less they are likely to turn around and sell weapons or buy fuel from Russia. Not to say that it's impossible, but it does mean that the relationship there is at least forced to stay at the current level instead of deepening.
Right. And this happened with other world leaders who are not as Ukraine friendly and are a bit closer to Russia. Although, again, the Russia camp itself doesn't exactly consist of many, so much as countries who are
dislike a bit more, the U.S. more.
This, or not even that, because I wanted to bring up Vietnam, which has a very good relationship with both the United States and Russia. But Zelensky had a good chat with the Vietnamese representatives as well. As well as like a host of other world leaders, he seemed quite popular there.
There was one world leader who went, one may say, out of his way to avoid speaking to Zelensky, and that is Brazilian President Lula da Silva, who, according to reports, literally hid from Zelensky to avoid meeting the man.
Just utterly childish.
Brazil, a few weeks ago, sent a presidential envoy, a presidential representative, to Ukraine, to Bucha, because Lula has publicly expressed skepticism of the various atrocities that Russia's committed on Ukrainian soil, including the atrocities in Bucha. And this presidential representative was sent to Ukraine, dispatched to kind of establish the truth of the matter. He was given the typical Zelensky administration tour to the various affected areas that had been under Russian occupation. Though his takeaway was meh, not convincing.
Yeah, so Brazil, the previous administration, Brazil was not good either. So we're not going to be taking sides in Brazilian internal politics there. But Lula is acting like just a basic internet conspiracy theorist idiot. And the final conference to talk about here is the China Central Asia Summit. It was held between China and the leaders of the various Central Asian countries in order to hash out some economic and security deals between them. One of the more important decisions they made was they wanted to open up a rail line to connect China with the various Central Asian countries, in especially for freight, but also passenger travel, of course. Because this would connect their economies to China even more. They made a variety of like security cooperation plans that we don't really need to get into. But basically, the idea here was that it brought Central Asia more into the Chinese economic orbit. This was full of pomp and circumstance. All the leaders of the Central Asian countries were greeted on this big red carpet with it looked like they were going to meet the emperor, which they kind of were. But who wasn't there was Russia. Russia is also very interested in Central Asia. Central Asia used to be part of the Soviet Union, what Russia traditionally sees as its sphere of influence. And not only were they being lured away from Moscow with, quite frankly, far more respect and adulation than Russia ever gave them, but they were doing it without Russia even being there. Typically, at these summits, there will be observers of countries that even aren't directly related to the negotiations taking place. And Russia tends to be involved with anything involving Central Asia. Not this time, though. So we had the Arab League, G7, China, Central Asia, all kinds of countries engaging in all kinds of diplomacy, making all kinds of deals and forming regional blocks, and economic and security decisions are being made. And who wasn't there? Russia. Not for any of them. Putin was not there for a single one of these. Part of the propaganda for this war was to create, you know, the multipolar world where Russia would be one of the major poles that control global politics, where everyone, where each of these major superpowers has to hash things out between themselves and without having to worry about the needs of smaller countries, just these superpowers talking to each other as relative equals. But Russia wasn't talking to anyone. And I think that is going to be the legacy of this war in Russia, is the withering away of any kind of diplomatic power that they might have had, when the whole point of it was to set themselves up as one of these co-equal superpowers throughout the world. And they have less influence than they ever did, including in its own, what they see, sphere of influence. And our last topic here is going to be a local one, just for local politics in Ukraine, which is a corruption scandal involving the former, well, now former, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Vsevolod Kniazev. Romeo, can you run this through what happened?
So Kniazev is being accused of taking a $2.7 million bribe. And to be honest, this is one of the clearer open and shut corruption cases that we've seen recently in Ukraine. Of course, he is only charged. He has not been proven guilty. So to say that he is definitely a corrupt piece of shit would be incorrect. He is only suspected of being a corrupt piece of shit. Specifically, like I said, he is suspected or accused of taking a $2.7 million bribe from one Konstantin Zhivago, an oligarch who was listed in 2003 as one of the youngest billionaires in Europe. Konstantin Zhivago owns the Finance and Credit Bank, one of Ukraine's largest banking groups, basically. And he has had a lawsuit going on since 2005 that he has apparently he decided presumed last year that he wanted to finally close. So he bribed the Chief Justice of Ukraine, who apparently took it. Now, the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, NABU, says that they have Kniazev on tape, recorded, talking about taking these bribes, discussing the detail of his bribes. They say that a raid on Kniazev's offices in the high court revealed $500,000 in cash. In his defense, the accused former chief justice claimed that virtually anyone can walk into his office and leave anything. And it's totally within the bounds of plausibility, Kniazev seems to be claiming, that someone would randomly walk into the office of the chief justice of Ukraine and just forget $500,000 in unmarked non-sequential bills. I'm joking, of course. We don't know if the mills were unmarked and non-sequential. We do know that they were significant, at least based on what NABU and SAPO, the Specialized Anti-Prosecutor's Office, are saying. The Supreme Court voted in favor of both removing him as Chief Justice on May 16th, and then later also consented to his arrest. So the rest of the judges on the court have apparently decided that the evidence really is so overwhelming. They're not going to fight for this guy. They're going to throw him to the dogs, or in this case, the anti-corruption authorities. As a result, the former chief justice of Ukraine is now sitting in jail and facing quite a bit of trouble. Again, $2.7 million is a large bribe, even by Ukrainian standards. And the brazenness and openness with which Knyazev discussed this bribe, according to Nabu, is kind of indicative of what is the larger culture in the Ukrainian justice system itself. We've talked about this numerous times. I've talked about one of my most hated judges in the world, and specifically in Ukraine, Pavlo Vovk. But Vovk, understand, is not a unique case. He is not special. He is just one of the most blatant and most open corrupt judges in Ukraine. He uses his corruption as kind of a calling card for people who want to win court cases in his court. Come to me, you'll win your case, but you have to pay me. But that is, it is not a unique or unknown culture within the Ukrainian judiciary. It seems to be, by all accounts, pretty widespread. Following the Euromaidan revolution, Ukraine did not go through with lustration, the process that was proposed to pretty much remove every single sitting judge, prosecutor, magistrate, and so on, and replace them with fresh faces that have not been dealing in corruption for 30 years. That did not happen. The same judges that have presided over Ukraine's incredibly corrupt legal system for the for the past 30 years are still in place and seemingly fine. Hopefully, the arrest of Knyazev, and assuming that the anti-corruption authorities do have a case and that they are that they do have the evidence to support their allegations and they can prove that in court, then this will be a very good signal to the rest of the judiciary that that sort of behavior that they have practiced for the last 30 years is no longer tolerated, and the anti-corruption authorities and the Ukrainian government can and will go after you no matter how lofty your position. So, assuming all of the anti-corruption bodies allegations are true and can be proven, then this may be a very good sign for the Ukrainian judiciary. But this problem is not limited to Knyazev or Vovk. It is a institutional issue with the Ukrainian judiciary itself.
Though I just wanted to say here that at the same time that Ukraine is prosecuting a Supreme Court justice for suspected corruption, if you look at the United States, we have Justice Clarence Thomas, who investigations now show is pretty much living directly off the largesse of a conservative oligarch named Harlan Crow, who is just paying for all of his stuff and all of his family's stuff.
No corruption there, folks. Just friends. Just friends doing friend stuff, like paying for your mom's house and also all of the renovations for your mom's house. That's just what friends do. That's what I'm doing for all of my friends, or would if I was a corrupt white nationalist billionaire.
A corrupt white nationalist billionaire whose entire life goal was to take over the judiciary
and dismantle all of the U.S.'s civil rights gains that it's made since the 70s.
While we look at this corruption case in Ukraine, I'm thinking of how before the full-scale invasion, we were pretty much a declared enemy of the Ukrainian judiciary system because of its corruption. And now we're seeing the Ukrainian judiciary having corruption handled within it better than the United States. So those are our topics for the week. Thank you all very much for listening. It was an extraordinarily busy week. I've been on the edge of my seat this entire time. But thank you very much for listening. If you would like to support this show, please rate us, review us on whatever apps you may use to bump us up in that algorithm. Share us with your friends. Talk about us. If you would like to support Ukrainian causes more generally, as always, look at the link in the description for our Linktree page about that. And if you'd like to support us financially, please go to patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype. So thank you very much to all of our patrons. Thank you, Deborah Grazer, Will Stevens, David Shepard, Dawson, Giorgio, Ivana Kokratskaya, Michael Drucker, Anna Karen Person, Anonymous, Devi, Etienne, Justin Devendorf, Kevin Albritton, Michael Wickman, Mike Perrone, Sam Toman, Shieldwall, Adam Poppenheimer, Aiden McDonald, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Big Rob, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Chris Walker, Crystal Burns, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Eric Honnold, Grace Kraus, Had to Laugh, Jacob Hoem, James Wise, Jenny Louise, Jerd, Julia Lindsay, Laura DeLeon, Levy Grove, Lottie, Marguerite Marks, Matt Miller, Melissa Koselko, MJ, Anonymous, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Randy McNerlin, Sanjay, Scott Gengris, Scott Tokayuk, Steve Bien, Stuart Akers, T. Bart, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, and Victoria Leontineva. Thank you all very much for your support. So until next week, Slava Ukraini!
Heroim Slava!